Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. My name is Catherine Crockett, and in this episode, myself and Saif Ahmad will be speaking to Mrs. Angela Spencer, Mr. Andrew Rogers, and Dr. Ajay Agarwal on the topic of health inequality. Mrs. Angela Spencer is a lecturer within the Division of Population Health, Health Services Research and Primary Care at the University of Manchester. Mr. Andrew Rogers is a lecturer in public health, health promotion and community development at the University of Manchester and managing director of Gwynalt Consulting, which specialises in community wellbeing and health promotion strategic approaches. Finally, Dr. Ajay Agarwal is a consultant clinical oncologist at Guy St Thomas NHS Trust and an associate professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. All three of our guests today have recently co-authored articles on health inequality for clinical oncology. The editorial authored by Mrs. Spencer and Mr. Rogers entitled The Importance of Tackling the Social Determinants of Health to Address the Unmet Need Within Cancer Services, Reflections from Build Back Fairer, the COVID-19 Marmot Review, is currently in press. Whereas Dr. Agarwal's article, What Science Will Deliver the Greatest Improvements in Cancer Outcomes Over the Next Decade, Health Systems Strengthening versus Technological Innovation, will hopefully be published in the near future. It's worth noting that we also reached out to the UK Department of Health and Social Care for an audio interview in relation to this topic, and in response they have sent us over a statement from a spokesperson that we will read out at the end of this episode. And so, without further ado, we hope you enjoy today's podcast.
So I was going to pick on Angela just because she was here first. So first of all, just to set a bit of scene, really. So what is meant by the term health inequality? And can you give us some background into the current level of health inequality in cancer services in the UK?
Health inequalities are the unfair and avoidable differences we see in health between our most deprived and our least deprived communities. And so Cancer Research UK, they do a lot of work around understanding inequalities in cancer care. So we know that there's more than 30,000 extra cases of cancer which are attributable to those socioeconomic factors that socioeconomic deprivation. Our most deprived groups are more than 50% likely to die from cancer than our least deprived, and survival is much lower. So we see inequalities from the very beginning in terms of risk factor exposure, such as smoking prevalence and obesity, to prevention measures such as screening and vaccination, where our vulnerable groups are the most least likely to partake in prevention measures such as that, and that obviously results in higher cases of late stage diagnosis and worse cancer survival in our most vulnerable groups.
And Andrew, have you anything to add to that?
All I'd say is that I think it goes even further than Angela's suggested, because even when it comes to prevention, there's a great inequality in our traction with different groups in terms of prevention messages. So those people in material deprivation are less likely to pick up on prevention messages around cancer prevention as well. So it's not even at the bit about risk factors, it's pre-risk factors. It's just whether people are actually engaged in their own health and well-being. And the way that we currently work around health education, health literacy stuff, it fails to reach those people most in need.
Okay, and Ajay, anything to add to that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is the process has been articulated by Angela and Andrew, which is the development of the disease in the first place. To what extent is your fitness when you do get a diagnosis and at what stage you are, and then how you transition through the system? And I think if I take on the system bit, I mean, the vast inequities in the system, not necessarily even based on your socioeconomic status, your comorbidity or your age. We're seeing that day to day in our care. There's that sort of sense of egality. And just to give just some general notion, you know, if you're diagnosed at a center which doesn't have a prostate cancer surgery site, you're 25% less likely to get it. If you're not diagnosed at a center that is part of a network that offers brachytherapy, you're 600% less likely to get it. These, you know, these are quite startling statistics. So we think we have a system that in its essence, people will have access to care that they need, but we know it's actually far from that. And it's actually dissecting that out, which leads to more the social determinants, as well as the way that our care is structured, which we really need to unpack.
Thank you for that introduction. And I mean, it seems like that there are some really, really grave consequences of these health inequalities. And to some extent, these have been known about for many decades, maybe not to the extent that we know about them now. There was the Marmot Strategic Review back in 2010. But in your opinions, then, you know, why do you think that we've not made as much progress on this front as we maybe should have? So, Ajay, maybe you could go first.
Yeah, no, it's a big question. And, you know, you mentioned about the Marmot report in 2010, but I think, as Angela and Andrew know, we talk about the Black report in 1980. We've talked about a huge amount of effort, evidence that we've had for the last 40 years. And it comes down to, in a simple fact, who you vote for. It depends upon what we think is the state's role in strengthening education, crime prevention, everything from housing and employment. They're all factors in the social determinants of health. So very much how much investment goes into those does have an impact. And we can see that directly from looking at countries, particularly in Nordic countries and Scandinavia, which have less degree of income inequality, for instance, and more investment in those structures and differences in health outputs. That's why I'm always slightly disagreeable when people think that you can deal with inequality simply by looking at the hospital end of things. It's actually societally positioned as well. So I think, actually, we've known about this for the last 40 years. I think 10 years is probably too short to put lots of these things in, but we've had periods of time where there's been investments, whether it's in Healthy Start programs, early life, the life course, the first 5 years of life, various things like that, and lots of really impressive things that I think we are international leaders on in many respects. So it's not all, you know, saying that we're terrible. We've done a lot of really innovative things from that perspective in managing those issues. But I'm sure Andrew and Angela bring in some more finer detail on those points, but that's from my thinking.
I totally agree with everything that you just said on that. Those political choices have not been made in the right way if we're going to tackle health inequalities. But it's not just the political choices about material deprivation and whether you put the investment into certain communities or not. It's also about the choices that you make in terms of whether you're going to restrict some of those cancer-causing industries. You know, we, without a doubt, it took us a very long time to listen to Don and Peter and deal with tobacco. You know, I'd been working 25 years in health promotion and public health before we started to actually see some restrictions on the advertising of tobacco products. We started to see taxation incentives really start to take hold and all sorts of things. It took most of my working life before I started to see some of that. All those policy decisions, all those policy ideas have been around a long, long time before governments started to act. That's just in the tobacco arena. If you then look at the food system, if you look at the pesticides that are used, and I could go on and on and on, but we know what the prevention measures are. We've already got the ideas that we need to put into place in terms of prevention, but we've still got governments which are not putting the two things together. You know, we've got a very good analysis of health inequalities. We've got a very good analysis of cancer prevention, and we also know what we're up against. We know what those industries are. We know the changes that need to be made to industry, but we're not having governments brave enough to actually put all that together and follow through. You know, we don't need more analysis about health inequalities and the prevention stuff. Professor Sir Philip Marmot has now done three reports, two before COVID and one during COVID, that has absolutely laid out in forensic detail the health inequality stuff. But we've got to have some politicians brave enough to follow those recommendations through. And that involves not just doing better health literacy, it means actually tackling some of the cancer-causing industries and actually putting some more restrictions on there to protect public health.
Thanks, Andrew. So I suppose I can just add in terms of talking about Marmot's review, probably I'll start with the 10 years on report. So that looked at progress since 2010, and we saw that the improvement we had been seeing in in health inequalities had started to plateau and even decline in some groups. So we, and a big impact of that was austerity measures and things like reduced social spending, increased taxation, you know, which were put in place since the 2008 financial crisis, had a real impact. And it did have a real difference in impact between our most and least deprived. And obviously now we've gone into a situation, we've got the pandemic. And then again, we've got that, how that has impacted on our groups has really looks like it's going to further increase those inequalities that we're seeing.
Just to add, I think, again, from the cancer perspective, Michelle Coleman's group, who deal with the sort of cancer survivorship, they did a review in the BMJ looking at the impact of policy or cancer policy over the last two decades on reducing gaps between socioeconomic strata and outcomes, and it's found that it hasn't been able to achieve that. But that's also partly because often the model of the way policy deals with it from a cancer perspective is that, oh, it's down to the cancer centre to be able to drive it. They can do one part of the puzzle, but it's as Andrew and Angela have alluded to, your predisposition to worse outcomes or being not accessing care is often determined by the social determinants of health, and it's that differentiation which I think is often forgotten in the discourse. So you can work on one element to it, but you need to act on the system as a whole and the underpinning factors from the social side to improve that.
Thanks for that.
Can I come in and make a further comment there?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things that I've been involved in recently in North Wales is looking at the inverse care law. So, and this is particularly about primary care more than anything else. So why is it then that primary care doesn't reach out to those people in most health inequality? Why does it not actually get to those people most in need? You know, most of the services, whether it's prevention or whether it's early detection and treatment or the screening services, if you actually look at who access them, it's people that are already engaged in their health and well-being. So one of the issues is that we keep trying to beat up primary care and say, you should be reaching further, you should be reaching out to these communities. There's a bit of a difficulty with it, really, because actually, at the moment, primary care is falling over. It's dead busy. It's busy already. And now coming out of COVID, it's getting even busier. So to say to them, OK, you've got to meet all those new demands. You've got to get your screening services up and running again. And actually, you've got to make it further. You've got to get to these people who don't engage with primary care. It's actually the wrong way to deal with a systematic issue. Primary care is never going to be good enough to be able to reach out with a pathogenic type offer to people, say the homeless or say transient communities, people that are not engaged in hardly any systems, that are really the ones that are at risk here. If you want to go to the far end of who's really at risk, there isn't currently an offer there from primary care to people like that. What is there are some good community projects that are starting to work with people, starting to get them to think about, where does health and well-being fit in your life when day to day you're struggling with just trying to feed yourself or trying to get a roof over your head or all these other things? Actually, to get into that headspace of thinking about my health and well-being, it's not a GP that's going to do that. It's not the health service that's going to move people to start to get involved in that for those people that really are most in need. It's those community projects. And what we don't seem to have is a systematic approach that puts the things together. We're starting to see it. We start to see some good examples of, say, food hubs that are now helping to move people in through the system. So people come to a food hub because they really are in need. But where's then that next add-on? Once you've actually started to feed people, how do you then start to build that conversation of, and in feeding yourself, what else do you need to know in terms of nutritional advice and make those connections then across the different types of service into primary care, etc.? And that's where we need to start putting, I think, a lot more attention.
Yeah, thank you for all those points. I just wanted to reflect on that. In one regard, is that one of the challenges, as you say, has been around policy, and obviously there's always choices with that, and governments have to balance so many things out. Do you think, you know, one reason is, and it's the classic reason why a lot of these things don't get better as quickly as they should, is because it just takes a really long time to see an impact with this. And if you're in power for 4 or 5 years, you're not going to get your money's worth or resources worth for addressing it. Or do you think it's more than that? Is that just a bit of a lazy way of putting it?
Yeah, I think we always highlight that as being a barrier to a lot of things like community work, you know, and community projects in general, which are a way of really engaging with your population to understand what in fact, you know, impacts on them. And so that has always been a barrier to that kind of work, because people want to see outcomes straight away. We know all these problems exist, but it does take a lot of work across a lot of systems and involve a lot of partnership to deal with that. And I think, like Andrew said, there's been a lot of good work that's happened, and the pandemic has presented an opportunity for a lot of work to bring people together. Certainly the work I've been doing with Manchester Local Authority and to reflect on the work they've done to try and engage with their communities to improve vaccination uptake presents opportunities for other services, and they've worked to understand the issues that affect their population. Ultimately, it was to improve vaccination uptake, but it was all about building trust, and that's something that's really suffered as a result of all these different things. But certainly with the way that the pandemic's been dealt with, it has had adverse consequences for our vulnerable communities. And so there is a lot of additional work now to do to build trust, and that's starting to happen, and that will help with engagement with some of our other health services like cancer services, which is what I hope will continue to happen.
And I hate to throw the Welsh flag in again, but I will, because this whole issue about the timescale of decision making has been really tackled in the last few years by the Welsh government. And we have something in Wales called the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, which combines health promotion and prevention with sustainable development. So what it asks is for every part of the public sector in Wales to think through every policy that you have in place, how does it improve wellbeing for people in Wales? Not just for this generation, but for the next generation. Maybe just think about that for a second. That's every single policy that goes through the government machinery has to meet those tests. How is it improving the well-being of people now and in the future? And not just this generation, but future generations. Now, it hasn't come to full fruition yet. It's been around for 5 or 6 years or so. And it hasn't been an easy policy, because it is about changing the tank, you know, changing the direction of the tanker, of the way that we do public policy making. But it's starting to make a difference. It's starting to make a difference that whether it's a health board, whether it's a local authority, everything that they do, they have to be thinking through what is going to be the long-term implications of what we're doing, not just now, but in 30, 50, 100, 200 years' time. So that's a massive shift. So that's one of the principles, but it's alongside some of the other principles of inclusion. So inequalities is one of the other factors that has to be considered, and prevention is one of those factors as well. So there are models of ways of working, and currently the Scottish government is looking at taking on board the Welsh Wellbeing and Future Generations Act, and seeing if it can also be enshrined in Scotland. I think we're some way off having that sort of mindset within the UK government, but slowly but surely things are nudging in that direction.
I know both Angela and Andrew both touched on the COVID-19 pandemic, so I just wondered if any of you wanted to elaborate further on the effects that you think it may have on health inequality and how we may go about trying to change that going forward.
Do you want the bad news or the really bad news on that one? I mean, we have to face facts. There's nothing that we know about public health, social determinants, the way the services are stretched, that won't tell us that the inequalities aren't going to widen. Unfortunately, we only need to, there's a really nice piece of work done by Rifat Atun's group in Harvard after the last 2008 recession, which showed that mortality increased in most countries, particularly for cancer mortality increased. That's essentially all the repercussions of what is an assault on the system. You know, unemployment goes up, crime goes up, poverty and social isolation increases. These, in effect, have twofold effect. It might actually affect direct access to services, but there's also the risk factor burden. You speak to anyone in the teams working with liver patients, they'll tell you alcoholism's on the increase, drug intake, social and domestic violence. So these are all factors that predispose both to the occurrence of cancer, the management of cancer, and the survivorship of cancer. How have people managed to bypass or to within the system which has been constrained as we know it? I mean, there's the first time that I've heard of where we were in the NHS December 2020 where patients were not able to have surgery in the NHS because of not enough staff. And so what was happening? Well, people bought themselves out of the NHS system and went to have private care. So that is a direct element. So the whole sort of public and private within the NHS was always, oh, well, you can top up X, but actually often there was a grey area as to whether it would improve outcomes. But here we're talking about 101 cancer surgery, you need it in a timely fashion. And that showed us in particular that actually if you did have resource, you could get quicker diagnosis and treatment during that time. With our capacity issues at the moment, I think can only see that broadening, more people having private care access and a system that's struggling to try and to deliver care with a more comorbid population. So I think just to stand still and to prevent those factors from really occurring, particularly with the risk factor elements, there needs to be investment to prevent a big plummet. You know, and we know that when there's sort of catastrophes like this, that does happen. That's just history. You can even take 1990s Russia after, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union at that time. So I think it's fairly bleak, but we need quite strong policy. And I think as a community, whether that's as clinicians, public health, and wider, we need to take this on board.
Absolutely.
I think, like Ajay touched on there, about thinking about the groups that some were more empowered as a result of the pandemic. They were able to seek out private health care when they needed it. And I think that's what we've seen as well, is that, you know, there were groups of people that found lockdown gave them opportunity to engage in their health. They were able to exercise, learn to bake, you know, learn other hobbies. But that just increases those disparities even more, because there were those other groups that weren't able to engage with basic prevention measures for the pandemic itself, because they were in crowded housing. They were in employment, which didn't allow for them to socially distance. So there is those increased and widening feelings. And so one group's feeling more empowered and another group's feeling even more mistrust of the government and the NHS. So I think that's creates other challenges as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we've known since, well, probably since about 2011, when there was a major piece of work by the Health Foundation and the Department of Health looking at motivational segments in the community. So which proportion of communities are actually really engaged in their health and well-being and are always looking for what they can do to improve their health. And we found from that piece of work that there are different groups. There are people who are simply living for today. And there are groups that are unconfident fatalists. They're just absolutely fatalistic about their health, don't really feel they have any control. And the reason why I'm saying this now is that all the indications through this period of different waves of COVID has been that those people that were engaged with wellbeing, as Angela says, have baked more, have got out and exercised more, have used that time. This massive shock to the system of, look, there's a virus and it can kill you, has made those people really think more carefully about health and wellbeing. And in response, are more than in tune with all the risk factors, heart disease risk factors, mental health, cancers. There are groups in society who absolutely now are thinking much more about their health and well-being and are now actively going and knocking on the doors of services for screening, testing, etc. But they're not the whole picture. They're just the people that already had some agency with their health and well-being. But if you're on the other end, as Angela says, these people that are fatalistic and unconfident about what they can do, for them, it's got even harder. It's not just that the messages that they're ignoring. There's now active echo chambers. There's mistrust of things like vaccines, and that then spills out into everything else. There are lots of things being said. I mean, I've seen in social media posts pictures of public health people, key public health people in the UK, and see and being labelled as fascists. Angela and I were involved in a public health conference earlier this year that got spammed, and people were coming in and trying to break up the Zoom calls by calling us health fascists. So there's an active attack on the health literacy of people who really do need to get involved in their own health in a different way. And all of what I've just said absolutely cuts through the thing about health inequalities. The unconfident fatalists, the live for today, is when you map out where they are the people who are in the most materially deprived circumstances. And those people that are much more in tune with their well-being are in better circumstances already. So that's just expanded through COVID.
Yeah, so just thank you. I mean, you've painted a challenging picture, to put it nicely. I guess sort of moving then on to potential solutions, I think, you know, we've already established that this is a very sort of knotty issue and it's one size won't fit all with that. But just to sort of reduce it down to sort of, you know, really key things, if I sort of took you, asked you one by one, if there was one major thing that you wish could happen and that you think will have a huge impact on this, what would you say that one thing is? And Angela, if you went first.
I think for me, it's building on the good work that's happened as a result of the pandemic. And like local authority have started to work really closely with their communities and voluntary sector and build that trust. And I think building trust is going to be key to it. So I think that's what I would like to see that to continue.
Yeah, complex. I've probably got 100 thoughts in my head, to be honest. But I think broadly, there's a sort of inequality in access and there's an inequality in outcomes. I think there's a variation. So if we take it from a cancer and a hospital model, there's a variation in the care that we deliver. We don't measure performance enough of hospitals themselves. We're not in a situation where you go to, you're going to get equal and good care. It's just unfortunately simply not the thing. There's a difference in decision making and the outcomes of that care. I think audit, and we're lucky we've got 5 national audits, have been able to start to look at these disparities. But as you know, Andrew's and Angela have alluded to, we've known about these for a long time and they'll say similar things. But I think where the missing step is our understanding of implementation science, to be honest. It's our understanding of actually how can we bring in the local authority piece, the stakeholder, the commercial determinants of health to actually try and bridge those gaps. And that requires a different skill set. I think we need to become much more multidisciplinary as a community working within cancer to actually understand, oh, that was interesting, there's a big disparity there, or you know, that's a great piece of tech, but only 30% of the population get it. But actually, that, how are we going to bridge that gap? And that's where implementation science comes into it. So I think there's a huge research or a health systems understanding component to moving forward with these challenges. We just need to invest more in it. We just don't have that resource at the moment.
And I'll just carry on from that, because I entirely agree. I was struck by AJ taking us back to, you know, some of this stuff. None of it's new. You know, I was there when the Black Report was squashed, or was attempted to be squashed by the government of its day. You know, there was an outcry from people working in public health and health promotion, and we were seen immediately as political with a large P. We were branded as left-wing politics. You know, it was all about that, and we were to be squashed, and were largely by the system.
For information, the Black Report into Health Inequality was commissioned in 1977, and for further details about it, there are some excellent resources online, including a summary by the Health Foundation.
We've moved a long, long way from then to now, and there's a lot of evidence about what does work and what doesn't work. You know, just the things that we've dropped into this conversation here today. You know, I've talked about the inverse curl law. I've talked about Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. There's a lot of stuff that we can just start to bring together what actually works and put it into a framework of implementation science. Then we could make some great strides forward. It's never been as challenging as now, but there have never been quite the opportunities to pull some of this stuff together as well. And it will mean that we have you know, conversations between those people like Angela and myself that are involved in prevention, those people that are involved in treatments and care. We need to get some of this together, recognise what the common issues are between us, look at good elements of practice, bring it forward, and as we're doing today, start to get them out there in different formats. It's not always about reading papers that come from the BMJ. It's great. Sometimes it's about doing a podcast like this and just sparking some ideas because you've heard something that you've never really heard before.
I just wanted to go back to, I think, Andrew, it was yourself that was making the point about certain individuals as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic being empowered to, for instance, bake and exercise more. And in terms of those individuals who remain reluctant or who are difficult to engage, any ideas on how we get those individuals to start to take responsibility for their own sort of health and take control of that?
I think for me, it's about what motivates them in the first place. On Saturday, I was at a football match for the first time in 3 or 4 years because it finally felt safe that I could go. And it's a non-league football team that I follow called FC United of Manchester. And they formed as a group in protest against Manchester United and the takeover of the Glazers and big money and all that stuff. So they're a community-oriented club. Now, the reason why I'm waxing lyrical about that is that everything about that football club now is rooted in the community. So at halftime, you can go and buy a pie and you can have a pint and all the rest of it. But you've also got local people who make alternative food provision as well. So you've got a couple of the supporters that put on a vegetable curry at halftime, cheap food. And because they've recognised it shouldn't all be about just drinking and eating pies when you go to football. There's more issues there. They also run the food hub for North Manchester. So this is a football club that run the local food hub. They do work with refugees. They've done work around gender and making sure that a woman's place is at a football match. There's all these different things that they've brought into this thing called going to a football match. And at the heart of it, there's the well-being of local people. So there's all sorts of different issues there. Now, if you can just work through, how do you have that conversation with, these were, hard-nosed football fans. Some of these were thugs, absolutely. But there was something about that dialogue that went on with them about, well, as you're turning away from all that football stuff you don't like anymore, what else do you want to change in the world? And they've moved on now to work on all these different issues about gender, about feeding local people, about, people's rights, all of that stuff from that initial conversation. We should be doing that with cancer prevention. We should be looking at, what is that conversation? How do you start to have conversations with people about health and well-being and about looking after you and your family and your community?
I suppose I'll just continue with what Andrew said in terms of, it's finding those organisations, those hubs, those trusted sources, people who can work with us in delivering a message and it be listened to. And so I think what we found a lot with COVID-19 was that it was, if it was branded government or NHS, it was like a no-go. But like Manchester local authority did a lot of work in terms of taking the branding out of it and having it come from a trusted source. And I think it's finding those trusted sources, working with them more and involving them.
And I think, Angela, sorry, we'll just follow on from that. We do know, we see it all around us, don't we, that when families and local communities have been hit by cancer, they're doing enormous things in terms of fundraising. Mm-hmm. It's about, how do you take that energy? And instead of trying to supplant it by then making it into something else and over-medicalising it, it's about empowering and helping them do their own education as part of all of that. Every time there's a new cancer fund run or whatever, use it as an opportunity to do some soft education in there and let people become empowered for themselves about what the things that they want to do.
I think social and community action is absolutely fundamental. And I think whatever area of health, whether it's cancer or infectious diseases, nationally, globally, is one of the most sustainable formats for bridging inequalities, because it's actually pictured in a way that matters to people rather than done as a sort of, oh, well, that's care or systems for other people that are not us. And I think we have to try and avoid policies that create people at loggerheads or on their beliefs or political ideologies. I think one aspect that I think needs to be protected, though, from a, and that's why I think a community-based approach is important. And a lot of the really good implementation science work looking at screening looks at populations and communities who are underserved by those rather than looking at the individual, because I think there's another agenda, which is around choice agenda, which is something that I look at a lot in my research, particularly with patient mobility for different care. And there's an assumption that everyone has the same choices, but those are in themselves socially patterned in terms of the rules of the game. You can go to Bourdieu or any of the sort of sociological literature, but fundamentally, if we say, well, actually everyone's got a choice and actually it's up to people to be empowered, well, actually that creates in itself quite inherent inequities, and people who are then access better care, you know, we could see it all the time, you know, younger, fitter, more affluent men and women tend to shop around for their care much more. So we just got to be very careful that we do as a community-based approach, that it's needs-led and that it's actually something that's going to be fundamentally sustainable rather than just political quips about, oh, well, we want to achieve choice for everyone.
Thanks for all that. And I mean, just coming towards the end of the podcast, I guess, flipping from the individual point of view, looking at sort of cancer research in general and how we sort of focus resources there, I guess one of the observations one could make is that there's a strong focus across cancer research about developing, you know, more and more novel therapies to have an impact on treatment, and potentially other interventions like radiotherapy or things around prevention, diagnostic screening seem to get less limelight. Would you agree with that observation? And do you think that's something that needs changing to help with the issues we've discussed?
I suppose from the field that we work in, myself and Andrew, it's public health in general. So prevention, health promotion, that kind of thing, it isn't given the same credit, and that's like Andrew said, and you've all said about the historical and political influences on that. So I think it's the same in terms of, you know, where we get our work published and the impact factors and the influence that has. I think we struggle to get that same credit when we put these, when we do the research, you know, to get the same acknowledgement and publicity around that work. So yeah, there's an issue and I'm not sure how to solve it.
Probably an area that I think about a lot in terms of the system, and especially in a position where I give two of the therapies, systemic therapies, radiation therapies, and, you know, work with surgeons and various things, and I can see how there's disparities. But in the same way that Andrew was remarking that we have a system where, you know, we've got issues still with tobacco and the policy around that, we fundamentally, you know, we're in a system where you pay to play. If you're going to pay for the research, which the pharmaceutical company you do, and we've gone from over the last 10 years 50% of, you know, trials and drugs being federally funded to now nearly 90-95% being pharmaceutical industry funded. And with that, you know, the infrastructure and the capacity in the different hospitals and the academic institutions, that's no doubt going to end up being a dominant driver in terms of what we assume is going to benefit us on a population level. But, you know, increasingly we also know that a lot of the innovations are at the produce benefits at the margins and not going to create significant improvements in our outcome. And I think we have to really understand health systems. But health systems is very multidisciplinary, you know, health economics, political science, behavioral economics, anthropology. And these are things where we look at not just the initial understanding of disparities, but how we traction them and the methods to do that. And you'll go to Manchester University, London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, there are lots of people invested in health from a health systems perspective, but neither the impact there nor the research funding. And I think we have to go back to basics when it comes to actually how we fund research to traction these big problems, because we're going to be here in 20 years time otherwise saying exactly the same thing, you know, where people think, oh, I need this drug to save my life, and actually they're not getting the basics in early diagnosis, good surgery, good radiotherapy. And so it doesn't take much investment, and it's not either or. You need to do both together. You need to innovate, but at the same time there needs to be a rational understanding that these problems really require a systems thinking approach, and we have the expertise you know, in our system locally and globally to do that. So I think we just need to work collaboratively together, and we need to educate. So I think there's hope.
Thank you. That's a really optimistic note to end on. And thank you to everyone for their time today. I mean, I've certainly learned a great deal, and you know, I'm sure our listeners will too. Thank you so much. As mentioned at the start of our podcast, we did reach out to the Department of Health and Social Care, and a spokesperson has said, "The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted more than ever the importance of good health, which is why we created the new Office for Health Improvement and Disparities to level up health and ensure everyone has the same opportunity to live a long, healthy life. Record numbers of people are now coming forward for cancer tests, with almost 250,000 checked in November. And the NHS staff have gone above and beyond to continue cancer screening and treatments during the pandemic. The government has backed the NHS with record levels of funding so it can make use of the latest technology and deploy more efficient, innovative ways of working, including setting up new surgical hubs and community diagnostic centres." With that, thank you very much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's podcast.